Magic.
And the world of illusion.
Magic TV.
And Craig Petty. Proudly present the Talk Magic Podcast. Every week we bring you awesome interviews with the greatest magicians that have ever lived. And now, here's your host, Craig Petty.
TV. My name's Craig. It is 9 o'clock, which means it's time for a Talk Magic. And today I'm here with somebody that I've known for a long time. This is somebody whose act is absolutely phenomenal. When you look up the quintessential magician, this is the person that you see staring back at you in the dictionary. He is brilliant. I've been a big fan for a long time. I am, of course, talking about the one and only Oliver Tabor. How are you doing, Oliver? You okay, mate?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. I'm very good. Thanks for having me on here.
Thank you for coming on the channel. I really appreciate it. And I meant everything I said there. You know that I've been a big fan of your act for many, many years. I remember the first time I saw your music act, which was at the IBM convention, if you remember. I was competing in the close-up and I was competing in the stage competition with...
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Slightly unusual. And you were competing in the stage competition and I was watching you from the wings. And I was like, right, there's absolutely no way in God's green earth we're going to win this, because that was just... perfect. And it was, and we'll talk about this later on, but that act and the way that you brought music and manipulation and the production of I think a cello at the end, wasn't it? I haven't seen that act for probably the best part of 8 or 9 years, and it still stands out as one of the, if not the best manipulation act I've ever seen. Like, and immediately I was watching you in the wings and I was like, he's going to win this whole thing, there's no one else who will come close. And what happened? You won it. Yeah, you're an amazing performer, Oliver. You really are.
Oh, thank you, mate. It's very, very kind of you. Thank you. Yeah, no, it was. I'll tell you what was really chuffed when we once. I remember when we watched the Wizard product review with David Penn. You were doing a review of David Souza's Red Envelope.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that DVD?
I do. Yeah.
And someone said, "Oh, you got mentioned the Wizard product review this week." I was like, "What? Oh, really? Did I?" And you mentioned, because you were saying about the kind of manipulators and saying people out there, and I think you said you listed the manipulators like Yu Hojin, and you mentioned my name. I was like, wow, that was really cool. It was amazing that you mentioned my name. I was really, truly chuffed for you to say something like that.
I've said it over and over again. I think that your act, your manipulation act, is one of the best I've ever seen. Like, and the problem with a lot of manipulation acts, and we'll get into this in a bit, but for me, I'm not a manipulator, as you know, but the problem with a lot of manipulation acts is they're either very old hat, or they do exactly the same thing as everyone else. There's no difference. It's kind of like, and there's no drama to it. It's like, I'm going to stand there and produce playing cards for 15 minutes and nothing else is going to happen. It's just going to be variations of producing cards. But with your act, it's kind of like, right, okay, it was all themed to music, and everything that you produced and everything that you did fit with that theme, and the musicality in the background was brilliant. And then it all built to a huge crescendo with the production of the cello, and it was incredible. I put you up there as one of the, if not the best manipulators in the world, in my opinion. So.
Oh, mate, it's very kind of you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. But no, I do agree with you. There's a lot of manipulation acts out there who just kind of produce things for no reason at all. And I used to be one of those years ago. The music act used to be, literally had no sense, no narrative, because actually it's a storyline about a musician who things happen to him because the sign changes from magic to music and all that. So it's actually got a running storyline through it. So there's reasons for things happening, which is always the reason when I put together a routine, I think there has to be a reason for things to happen. You know, it makes it more interesting for the audience to watch it. Like with anything, when he's telling a story from a close-up routine, card trick, whatever, it ends up much more interesting. But there are exceptions about people. I mean, I do understand what you're saying about manipulators, but there are exceptions. Some of the Koreans, for example, like Yu Hojin, for example, is just, it's beyond perfection. You know, that's an act that you can just watch over and over and over and over and over again. And it's just done beautifully. It's like Lance Burton's act. I think Yu Hojin is kind of that same sort of pacing, that same beautiful kind of like really candy for the eye that you don't have to really concentrate that much, but you just enjoy what's happening, you know? Yeah. Totally. It's just like I do a lecture, and in there there's actually this one of my lectures from a book called Roy Benson, who was a great manipulator, the Benson Ball routine and all that. So Todd Carr and Levant wrote an amazing book. It's my favorite book, called By Starlight. And in there, Levant listed the kind of fundamental rules of stage magic, which is basically all the kind of rules of stage magic manipulators tend to follow, but they've never actually been written down before. So he put them all together. Things like, you know, the bigger movement masks the smaller movement, things like that. And one of the things in there is, don't necessarily separate yourself from the trick. And I say this in my lecture, and basically my interpretation of that is don't make anything too fussy. So it's like, for example, if you're doing a routine and I need to go and steal something, then I've got to walk over there, steal it from the back of a box, and then come back again to produce it and steal something else. But that, it's better to have everything on your person. So this is basically kind of what I'm going with this. So I used to have all my props on the table. I used to go and steal them from there. But I put all the props on my person, so all body steals. And that way, I didn't have to move. There was like, it's taking a script and taking out all the words and unnecessary. It's taking out any unnecessary movement. So it means I can just stand in place and just present the magic as strongly as possible. And Yu Hojin and people like that are a master of it, because he doesn't move really. He just moves around very slightly, very much to kind of, you know, his body around. But he doesn't really move around. He doesn't even have a table. He just stands there and does real magic, you know, just the most amazing magic. Like Lance Burton as well, he didn't have to move anywhere really. He just stand there and present everything, because it was just so beautiful to watch. Mm-hmm. So there is an argument, I think, for that side of it. But there's also not manipulators or manipulation acts in the past who just produce things for the sake of it without any reason for it behind it, you know. And it's I understand where you're coming from.
You are right, and that what you've just said there absolutely sums up my thought process, that there is a narrative, a story running through your acts. You know who you remind me of? Another one of my favorite manipulation acts, Soma. His phone act has the same story,
yeah,
going through the whole act, you know, the newspaper and the whole thing, and the it's the same sort of thing. You can see, even if you're not listening, there's no words to listen to. Just by watching what's happening, you understand what they're trying to put across to you.
Yeah, absolutely. I think actually I was influenced a lot by going to FISM and watching acts, because back in those days you'd have to have an act which had a storyline or a theme to it, which is kind of why I came up with the violin act in a way. I was watching people like Young and Young, who did the Englishman New York act that these, I don't know if you saw that. They were amazing. And all those kind of German acts and Topaz and people like that all had an underlying storyline, you know, had something, a narrative to follow to. So I think that's where mine came from, because my act originally was just come out and just produce cards and with notes on them and just do things with the violin, take it apart. It had no actual story to it. And then going to watch FISMs, I was like, oh, actually I need a kind of a storyline to it. So I was like, I kind of had this idea of the sign changing from music to magic. And then it kind of gave it the running. So basically my whole act literally is down to my sign. That's the whole, because I come on as a musician, about to play something, and then the sign changes without me knowing, from music to magic. And then things happen. Or Joe changes to a cane, the strings settle out my violin, and therefore I turn all my music props into magic props. So it has a running narrative, and then the sign change at the end back to music, and I have to go back to where I started. So it kind of is like full circle. That's kind of the idea of it.
And I love it when an act does actually go full circle, and you kind of have something at the beginning that you return back to at the end. That's great.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's so many great acts out there like that. But funny enough, actually, the act came back, so I used to play the violin years ago. That's where it all came from. So before I took up magic, I used to play the violin. Actually, I was supposed to play the viola. And the viola is like it's a bigger instrument, because I've got big hands. So my music teacher asked me to play the viola. So I used to play in an orchestra years ago before that as well. What my music teacher didn't tell me is that viola section actually is the joke of the orchestra. It's like we take the mickey out of the Irish. So apparently there are sections that, because they just fill in all the notes that the violins don't want to play. They just play all the leftover notes. That's basically what it is. So yeah, actually, I think I was influenced by a lot of people like Soma, and especially acts from FISM as well. A lot of FISM acts tend to have that storyline. So I went to FISM in 97 in Dresden, not knowing actually what FISM was. I was working for Davenport's at the time, and then I heard about this World Championships and went there, and it's just like this, the first time you go to FISM, you always remember it. It was 97 in Dresden. It was the most amazingly well-organized convention I've ever been to. And they were sat there watching these acts around the world, these amazing high-class, amazing, incredible acts. And Roy Davenport was entering that year as well, and that's the year he came third in manipulation.
Wow.
And his act actually had a storyline running to it because it was all about the Waterloo. So at that time, all those acts kind of had those kind of underlying stories, had a theme to it. So that kind of gave me the idea about doing this this dub violin act. And actually originally came from me playing the violin because I kind of played the violin before I took up magic. So so I actually used to play the viola, which is a bigger instrument. So yeah, I kind of fused two hobbies. I got into magic when I was about 13 or 14. I was playing the violin.
I was going to say, what was your origin story? When did you get into magic? How did all that come about?
Pretty much, I think, like every magician, really. I used to go for Christmas. All the families to go up to watch the Christmas lights and walk to the Hamleys. Saw them demonstrating a Svengali deck, and then that was it. It was like, can I have a box of tricks for Christmas? And there was the Magic Circle Deluxe box of tricks, the Varvins one. And my mum bought me the compendium of card tricks. It's like 250 card tricks, which is a lot of card tricks. No one needs to learn that many. So anyway, so I got into that. And then just that was it, really. Started doing kids, families, kid shows. And then went on from there. I discovered local magic clubs, everyone does. And then I went to discover Davenport's when I was about 15, I think, which is kind of like the real Harry Potter moment. You know, you walk in there and it's like, oh my God, this is just amazing. The absolute, you know, exactly definition of how you imagine the magic shop to be. Mm-hmm. So I joined the Demon Club there at Davenport's, which was their Young Magicians Club. And this was the kind of the Young Magicians Club before the Young Magicians Club at Magic Circle, mm-hmm. Before that existed. So, which is the most incredible club. I've given so much to magic clubs. I think you do as well. I think magic clubs are so important. And this one especially was, so a big influence on me. So I joined when I was like 13, 14 years old. And the people in this club, it was a very relaxed club. We used to meet every Saturday afternoon in the studio beside the shop. And you had people like Richard Griffin, Angelo Carbone, Steve Mulhern was a member for once. You've got other people like Paul Henry used to work at the shop with, and Stephen Jesson. Basically, about 90% of the people who were part of that club were going to do professional, you know, perform professionally. It was just a great, great club, run by Fergus Roy and Ossie Betty. But it just produced so many great magicians. So I was influenced. I remember seeing Richard Griffin's act. We used to do a show every year for the public, and we used to do a show for the Magic Circle every year as well. And the first time I saw Richard Griffin perform, I was side stage at the Players Theatre when I used to meet there. And I'd never seen the sort of magic before. So I was doing, I think, comedy magic at the time, which is probably wasn't a good thing. I carried on. I wasn't very good at that. and so Rich Griffin was always the end of the show. He's always like the main guy because he'd won Young Magician of the Year in 1989. He'd won the British Magical Championships. He'd won the IBM. He's literally done it all. He was like the big guy at the time. And so I watched him side stage and saw him do his amazing dub act. I was like, yes, that is it. That's what I want to do. You know, a massive light bulb went above my head. It's like, that is it. And I was lucky to have Richard because he basically kind of gave me a helping hand to get stuff magic and it kind of all went from there. So I started when I left school. I worked at Davenport's for 5 years. That was kind of like my university, if you like.
Quick one about that. So did you plan at that point when you were a kid and you were learning magic, did you want to become a professional magician or did you want to make money from magic at that point? Was that something that you wanted to do? And when you went to work at Davenport's, was it full time? Or were you doing some sort of education or were you doing gigs at the same time as well? How did that all come about?
I think like every young boy's dream was to be a magician. I think I always did. I'm very lucky. I had a very supportive mum and dad. My dad's a farmer. Farming wasn't really for me. It's too much like early mornings, to be honest. And I was very supportive. They're very supportive of me. I think it's because I was earning money before I left school. I worked in a pantomime backstage for 1 year, for one Christmas, and I worked for Marvin's Magic in the local Debenhams at the Lakeside, and they see that I had a passion for it, and I was really wanted to carry on with it, so they supported me. So I wrote to Betty and Fergus and said, look, was there any chance of having a job here, because I knew them anyway from the Demon Club. So I went straight from school from doing my GCSEs and worked at Davenport, so it's a full-time job. That's literally all I did, but it was the most amazing 5 years I think I've ever had. Because you were meeting, like I was meeting everyone, I was learning new tricks all the time as people coming in, you know, surrounded by amazing people, you get visits, because Betty and Fergus were like the royalty of the magic world. Mm. So you'd have visits from everyone, from Paul Daniels to Jay Marshall and Penn & Teller, you know, it was just an amazing place to be for those 5 years. And this was from like 95 to 2000.
Wow. And obviously on this channel recently, I interviewed Daniel Young, who was obviously I think he was with, was he there at the same time as you?
No, I'd left by then. I think he was there about 5 years after. Okay. After me, there was a guy called Paul Brown, who was the head demonstrator there. And then I think Dan was after that.
Okay.
So I think Dan must have been there for about, I don't know, 8-9 years, something like that. But there is a thing about that. The problem is, I have to say, Davenport's was great and it's fantastic. But when you do a whole day's work, so I used to commute, I live in near Southend in Essex. So you commute up to London, which is about an hour and a half up to Davenport's, which is fine. I'd love to do my job anyway. I don't mind doing that. But after a whole day's work and then coming home, the last thing I actually wanted to do was then go out and do gigs. It was kind of like a full-time job, doing 5 or 6 days. Sometimes I used to work on a Saturday. So after time and after 5 years, I lost the ton of love for magic, you know, because I was doing a job, nothing against Davenport's, but I was doing a full-time job and you're doing the same thing every day. And I just lost that kind of that enthusiasm for magic. So I kind of drifted away from it a bit. And I didn't want to, you know, I was really sad because I love magic and it was my life and I didn't want to kind of lose it. So I took a year out and my sister was going backpacking around Australia and I saved up enough money. I need a year out to do something different. I just took a break from life completely and went backpacking around Australia, which was the best year I ever had. I think it was an amazing, amazing time. It was kind of like just living a good life, you know, and it opened your world, opened your eyes to the world as well. And whilst I was traveling around Australia, I slowly got back into magic. I got a couple of books and bits and pieces, just kind of get back in and started performing whilst out at parties and that sort of thing. And then I came home and then I had to make a decision what I was going to do, really. Start from scratch. I wasn't working in the shop anymore. And then I saw an advert in the Stage for a new illusion bar that's going to be open in Spain, Salou, called the House of Illusion. And this was the first year. This had been set up. So I did an audition. I put together like a little jumbo coin routine for my act. And what did I do? I did a photocopy, I think. Paul Gantler's photocopy with a photocopied hand.
Yeah.
So I did that at the audition. There was Rodney. There was, I think Wayne Goodman was there. And Mike Rose for this audition. So I went in there and did that. And there was audition for dancers and all sorts. And there was a few magicians there as well. So I didn't hear from who got the job. But I did get a phone call from Rodney, who was running it, and apparently he went to Davenport. So he was decided between two people because they're basically getting a whole new, you know, about 5 or 6 magicians to open up this new House of Illusion. It's the first year, and he couldn't make a decision between me and someone else. I don't know who it is. So he went to Davenport's and he spoke to Betty. And by this point, I was kind of like, well, I don't know what, if I don't get this job, I might just go and do something else. It was a real kind of turning point. And Rodney said, look, you know, I knew Oliver used to work here, and we're thinking about getting for the House of Illusion. And Betty's like, oh yeah, Olive's fantastic. He does an amazing dub act. And at that time, I wasn't doing the dubs. I kind of gave up for a couple of years. And because of Betty, bless her, I actually got the job. Wow. So it was a real turning moment because I was almost going to give up magic at that point. And then Rodney was like, well, I've heard you do this dub act. And I was like, well, I haven't done it for a long time. I was like, well, if you can bring the dub act out there, then you've got the job. I was like, okay, cool. So amazingly, yeah, Betty helped me. She kind of like made the decision for my life. So it was a real turning point.
That's amazing. Now I want to carry on with this story, but before I do, let me ask you one question. A lot of what you've been saying at this point, a lot of the magic you've been doing has all been stage-based magic. A lot of other magicians that are young, that get into magic, especially these days, it's not stage magic. It's close-up magic. They'd rather get themselves a deck of cards and 4 coins than a cage full of doves and a pack of manipulation cards. What made you gravitate towards the stage side of things? And did you ever consider kind of focusing on close-up as well? Because I know that even now you don't focus on close-up. A lot of your bookings are staged. Was that from a desire to want to be on stage, or was that, you know, what was the... How did that all come about?
I think so. Yeah, I mean, I do close-up magic, but it's not kind of the main thing. I always have done. Cards are special. I love card magic. So I was doing close-up at the time, but I think just that whole era in kind of like 95, 96, you had these amazing stage acts like Richard Griffin, Philip Hitchcock, Leo Ward, and all these great, amazing acts. I used to sit at the Reading Junior Day and all these other things. And I used to see these people in these gala shows. It's like, I want to be there one day. I want to be on one of these gala shows. Going to Ron Willen's Day and seeing these big like Macatendo and all these amazing manipulators. And I was like, that's what I'd like to do. Always wanted to just do lecture, you know, get to the point of being able to do lectures and gala shows. So I think that's kind of where it came from. But it's It's I have to say, it's really, it's a sad state of affairs, because I love Save Magic and I love what I do and I love the stuff that we do. And there's not many people that want to do it these days. But I just think it's because of the influence around me. There was all these amazing stage acts and everyone's doing Dove Magic, and I was entering competitions like the Young Magician of the Year, like Keenan Laser, and Dominic Wood was doing the Dove Act. And all those people in those days wanted to do the stage magic, wanted to do the Doves. Always in those days, it was the Dove Acts that used to win the competitions, and it was always, that was kind of seen as the best thing you could do. Mm. But as years went on, I think it's also from influences from other people, like, you know, David Blaine came along and they made Magic Call, you know, and you had Darren Brown that made magic, you know, different sort of type of magic. And the reason I stuck with it is when working at Davenport's, is you'd see people being influenced overnight. So I always wanted to do stage magic and continue doing it. It wasn't always easy to find the work for it, but I always wanted to stick true to myself and do what I loved, and not try and do other things. So we used to get customers come in and they'd do kind of like, you know, they'd wear kind of like a tuxedo and a, you know, like a bow tie. And then David Blaine came along, and obviously everyone wanted to be like David Blaine. So everyone changed in a t-shirt, jeans, and they presented, but they people actually start talking like David Blaine. We'd still have customers in the shop and they start putting them as a voice. And I was like, okay, that's cool, we understand. And then 2 years later, Darren Brown came along, and these same people then completely changed their look, put on a suit, started doing mentalism, started talking like Darren Brown. And I'm like, oh man, really? So I just found that a little bit disheartening. I just think if just take something which you're good at and what you love and just stick to it, you know, stick with it. And that's what I've always kind of kept in my mind. I've always wanted to do what I love rather than changing. I mean, I guess you do have to change with the scene and change with kind of the what's going on out there. But I just always want to stay true to myself and do what I love rather than have to do anything else. And that's, I guess, why I always have done, still do stage magic. I mean, I do close-up. You have to, really, to earn a living. But stage magic is always my main passion, massively.
Do you have any advice for putting a stage act together before we carry on with the story? Like, do you have it? Because I speak to a lot of close-up magicians that want to perform on stage. They're looking for opportunities to perform on stage. There are more opportunities to perform on stage now than ever before, especially with comedy clubs and open mic nights and, you know, holiday parks, obviously, and corporate events. And stage magic is definitely getting a renaissance. How, or what advice would you give to somebody who's watching this that wants to perform on stage but has never done so before?
That's a good question. Yeah, I'd say it sounds a cliche, but just go out and do it. I think it's really the only thing you can really say. I just think that's all you can do. You can give as much information, as much advice to people as possible, but that you just got to go and do it. You know, you can learn a million routines, but just go and try it. Go and perform where you can, do it where you can. And I'd say make an act which is 100% angle proof as well. Do it wherever you can. Design an act that can come out of one case. I've designed, over the lockdown, I designed a case, an act that comes out of one case that can be done pretty much surrounded and also fits in one case, because my dive act fits in two cases and we've got illusions and that sort of thing. And I just want to make it as easy for you as possible. But just, yeah, I kind of, that's really the best advice, is just go out there and do it. Find any stage you can do it and do open mic nights. So there's some magic nights out there which are free. You can try out material, you know, and just go out and do that. Just try it out and ask for notes as well. After every show, get some second along with you, you know, a friend or someone you trust, and ask for notes. I think it's really important. Ask for advice and you know, listen to it and work on it and record yourself.
Yes.
Yourself, absolutely. Record your rehearsals and record your performing live is very important.
The amount of times I've had an amazing idea for something and I've recorded it in rehearsal and I've looked back and I'm like, man, this sucks. It's so true.
It's kind of like, you know, you get to a certain point performing in the mirror, everything's about performing in the mirror, but you have that you know, that blink point at the most important part where you're doing a slight, which is good to a certain point, but then record yourself, just, you know, there's no holes barred. Literally, you'll see everything. You'll see it raw. As painful as it is, when you say we've got a great idea and you think, oh, it's amazing, you look at it and say, oh, it's rubbish, I'll scrap that. It's heartbreaking as it is. But yeah, that's it. I know, who is it? I think it's Noel Britton. Whenever he does a show, he's good friends with Richard McDougall. And I know every time he goes and sees him, every time he comes off stage, he asks Richard, so have you got any notes? Even to today, you know, he's always asking for feedback. And I think that's really important.
And this is a guy that's at the top of his game, like, is incredible. So, I mean, if he's doing it still now, then there's no excuse for anybody else not to.
Yeah, absolutely. And even actually Derren Brown, I went to see Derren Brown locally at the Cliffs Pavilion Theatre here in the South End. And he was coming to the end of, I can't remember what show it was now, a couple of shows ago. But he's coming to the end of his run, of his tour. And Andy Nyman was in the audience taking notes. And this is like three shows at the end of his tour. And he was still changing and taking notes.
Well, I interviewed Preston Nyman the other week.
Oh, right. Cool.
And Preston actually said the same thing. He said that even on the last night of that run, even when that act is never going to be done before, it was still notes were taken and it was discussed afterwards. Even when they were never going to do it again.
That's great, isn't it? That's so interesting. Mm. Yeah. Yeah, so,
there you go. It's true. Back to your story. So you almost quit Magic, which is just mind-blowing for me to think, because you are, unfortunately, obviously, I genuinely mean this, by the way. You know I don't blow smoke up people's asses. Daryl's no longer with us, rest in peace. And Daryl had that whole thing as the magician's magician. I kind of think of you as the magician's magician. Like, I watch you perform. However you're performing, whatever you're doing, and it's like, okay, that's what a magician should look like. That's how a magician should act. That's what, it's brilliant. It baffles the mind that you were close to quitting. That's just, oh my gosh. But you ended up going over to the House of Illusion. Did that rekindle your love of magic? Because obviously you just spent a year in Australia backpacking, you'd come back, you got this gig. Was it a fun experience? Did it kind of get you back up to where you needed to be?
That is exactly what I needed, yeah. It was possibly the best thing I could have ever done because you're working with five or six magicians every day. Mm. And it was the first year, so it wasn't like the most successful year. I think Rodney even says that it's his worst year he's ever had. So it's still finding its feet. But it was an amazing show. We had like things like the buzzsaw, the elevator. We had the shadow box, cube zag. Plus the Dava, it was a cracking show. And it managed to fit it in this little kind of, it was an Irish bar, and the stage is where the pool table was, and they managed to fit all these illusions in there and do the show. It was amazing. So it was like the first House of Illusion room, and it was an Irish bar, but it was great fun. So I was over there with Matt Edwards and Joel Dickinson, Wayne Goodman, there's a guy called JJ, doesn't do magic anymore. And Scott Pepper, who I then went to work on later on. So it was a real kind of great mixture of people there to work with. It was exactly what I needed, a real kind of ejection. I really needed to get back into magic. And I was doing the Dav acts like two or three times a week. I was getting into it and trying out different things. And yeah, it was fantastic. So we did the year over there. And then Rodney put me together with Scott Pepper, who was at that time a comedy magician. Mm-hmm. Puts together out to some of his hotels that he supplied entertainment to. And I kind of did half of my show and Scott did half of his show. So it was kind of like chalk and cheese. He was a comedy magician. I was the straight guy. And it worked really well. So we did that for a few shows over there. And then as soon as the House Illusion finished, we came back home and we put the act together. Got in touch with a few agents, including Trevor George of in the Southwest, who kind of gave us a chance. And we started doing holiday parks at that time. So the act was called Amazing the Muse at the time. So it's very much Holiday Park kind of name for it.
But, you know, I mean, you talked earlier on about flight time. Holiday parks will do that for you. I mean, I spent 2 years doing holiday parks. And, you know, the thing, if you've never done them, you don't know. But, I mean, if you suck, they will let you know in a heartbeat.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's it. It's like, I think it's equivalent to actually working on the street, I'd say. I think that a good place to learn is either work on the street, which I never did. I wish I did, because it teaches you so many different things about how to control an audience. And also, I'd say, people that work on the street, you can always tell who they are. So I put on shows throughout the year. If you book someone from the street, their energy levels are so big. You know, they really know how to perform compared to someone who's kind of brought up a different way. It's really interesting to watch. You can always tell who's worked on the street, but then bowled up to different acts, like Matt Ricardo, for example, the juggler, and people like that. You could tell that they've kind of worked on the street and still do. You know, they're still very, very, very alert. Holiday Park. So we did those for like two or three years. But yeah, it's a good ground. It's a good place to kind of say, just trying to do your time, So we did it for 3 years, I think, we did the holiday parks. And, you know, our books were filled. By the third year, we were getting residencies and doing everywhere. And basically the whole thing was basically I was the serious magician and Scott was the kind of the comedy magician. I remember we got a stage review once called, and he was called the Kooky Sidekick, and he really didn't like that. Went down too well. But it worked really well. So I'd come out and we'd do a couple of bits and pieces. I'd do the dove act and then Scott would try and copy me. So you come out and he'd produce a KFC bucket and produce a chicken. Well, I produced a dove, I'd produce a chicken and we'd try and copy each other and he'd try and do what I could or then he couldn't do it. And it worked really well. So we did that for 3 years and we tried to get on ships at that time. But the problem was our act was very much holiday park, you know, case for them. And I was chance to do my own solo show and so was Scott. And then we got a chance to work in theatre. That's kind of our next place to go up from it.
Mm.
So we did, there's a company called Macro Productions that do theatre productions. They did the Babcam Theatre, kind of like the summer, end of the pier show type of thing. And they were looking to put one at the Eastbourne Royal Hippodrome Theatre. So we went and did our act in front of an audience. It was the best way, actually, I think, to showcase or audition is they basically, Colin, who runs this business, would take a few acts, put them on a show, just put them on a variety show and see what the reaction was in front of the audience, which I think is a great way to audition people.
Definitely.
So we got the contract for the following year. So that was from March to October. It was three nights a week. It was an amazing contract. And it was kind of glitz and glitter, more for the older generation, you know, kind of like the Shearings kind of coach trips. But we had, you know, I'm part of a cast as well. There's like four dancers and a couple of comedians and it was just great to be part of. So we did, I did a version of my act, a dancing hanky, the one that flies around the theatre. Yeah. I had that on the PTS system. Scott did his bit and he was doing some illusions that time. And we did a version of our kind of dove and chicken act and did that for that season. It's really good. And by the end of that season, we decided to kind of split our ways because we realised if we want to get work on cruise ships, probably best to do it by ourselves. Yeah. And as soon as we did that, we both got cruise contracts in each. So it was the way to go.
Absolutely.
So, so he did some P&O ships and he was trying to get the American ships. And from then, I then did the season, the Bournemouth Pier Theatre for the same company and did a few of those. And they're really good fun. I have to say, they're really, really good fun. Again, it's a good place for grounding and learning new skills. Like I had to sing and dance, right, which I've never done before. But it was great to do because you're part of this ensemble cast. I was part of the sketches and those sketches are kind of based on things like the old two Ronnie sketches and they bring those old ones back and you become part of those and it was just really good fun. I guess kind of like being part of a pantomime. Not I've done pantomime at all, but it's that same sort of, you know, that fun to being part of the cast. So did about three or four seasons of those and then started doing the cruise ships at P&O, which is by myself. And then from then, the burlesque market was coming big. At that time, you had this kind of renaissance of this cabaret in London, of the burlesque scene. And I really wanted to get into that because I thought it was really interesting. I was like, well, I probably could work a 10-minute act in part of those shows, which is kind of what I wanted to do. So I tried to get into that and I've kind of been working on that scene. And you had things like Magic Night that was on in Soho as well. And all these kind of little nights popping up, which was quite an exciting time. For magic and magicians, and Magic Night was fantastic. I got a chance to work with like Barry and Stewart, and it's where Piff started as well, and Matt Ricardo, and mixing with all these people. It was a great kind of community to be part of.
That's amazing. While all this is happening, because obviously you're telling us this story from working the House of Illusion, your career has steadily gone on an upward trajectory. First of all, you got into the holiday park circuit, then you got into your own theatre, then you ended up with your own solo show and you're doing this and you're doing that and doing the other, you're really kind of moving up the echelon. At the same time, were you entering magic competitions as well? Because obviously I've seen you enter quite a few magic competitions. You've beat me in several competitions. Like, was that as a result? I suppose the question I've got to ask is, was that happening at the same time? And what was the reason for entering the magic competition? Was it to test yourself or was it for social proof and a way to further your career? I mean, where did all that come from?
I think it's more a personal goal, to be honest with you. I've always wanted to win a magic competition. And I think also actually from looking at when I went to Dresden and FISM and I saw Roy Davenport get up and come third. And, you know, obviously proud because I was working with Davenports at the time. But I was kind of like, this whole new world of these big magic competitions opened up, and I looked at all these award winners on stage. I was like, I want to be one of those one day. I want to be up there. And I guess that's where the Violin Act kind of took its path. As like, well, I'd like to be able to get to the point of be able to enter FISM, because also you have to be selected these days. You have to be sponsored to say you're good enough standard. So that was always my aim. Actually, saying that, behind all these other shows, that has always been my top aim, was to win a competition and get into FISM. Not necessarily win anything at FISM, because I thought that's just completely out of my league. But that was actually always been my driving force. It had been since I was 18, with that Dove Act, was to work it. So I was always working it over the years and trying to work as much as possible. All these shows, these ensemble car shows. But that was always my driving force. That was always my motivation, as I always wanted to win a competition. So yeah, I was entering competitions all the time. So I entered the 2006 IBM, I think it was the first one I did, apart from the Young Magician of the Year some years ago. So 2006, which is, I can't remember who won, I think it might have been Romany that won that year. And then I entered the 2010, I think, and I came third. Then I entered the State Magician of the Year for the Magic Circle and came second, which is real kind of hard buzz. I think Pete Wardell won that year. And that was quite cool. And I think that's kind of, I don't think many people kind of realize what I was there, if you understand me. It was kind of like the first time I think people kind of saw the act, if you understand what I mean. And then there's like, well, the European Championships was being announced, or the FISM was coming to Blackpool. And I was like, oh, now this could be an opportunity. So at that time in my act, I was doing a dove cage to a violin. And I always had this idea of turning a cage of doves into a cello. I always had it in the back of my mind. I was like, if I enter FISM, that's what I'm going to do. So I entered the European Championships in 2011. I was doing a season at the Cromer Pier. I was doing the Christmas show. So I was working my act in there. I was doing it 10 times a week for a month. Mm. Well, we got to a nice standard to be able to kind of go and enter it. So Jack Delvin was the president at the time. And I said, look, would you be able to sponsor me for the Magic Circle for FISM for the European Championships? And he's like, that's fine. So I did that. I did the European Championships. Apparently, I was a couple of points off of being placed, but I just wanted to do it just for experience, purely just for experience. And it's the Blackpool stage, like the biggest stages in the world. So then FISM was the following year, the actual main championship, sorry, the World Championship. So I had 10 months to get this cello made.
Yeah.
So I made it out of cardboard, and I was like, I know how to work it. And then approached a guy who lives not far from me, who makes sculptures out of polystyrene and fiberglass. And then we've managed to, over the course of months, managed to get this thing working and got it ready just in time for FISM. I probably wasn't quite ready for it, to be honest with you. The World Championships was a big deal, you know. And I think I was trying to find the running order to tell you today, but I know I was on after a Korean manipulator, which I think it could have been Lucas. So I had to follow him, right? Which is just like putting yourself in the deep end.
Yeah.
So, and it wasn't, I wasn't ready for that. It was okay. The act went okay. But it wasn't great, but it scared the hell out of me. But I have to say, if you do something like that, it really makes you bulletproof. So if it could be an advice to give anyone, yes, there's things out there saying, make sure, you know, do something that scares you every day, or put yourself out of your comfort zone. Like when I did those, the end of the peer shows, I always had to sing and dance, and I was out of my comfort zone, but it was nice. I enjoyed it. And it gives you a different skill.
Yeah.
The same with these competitions. First thing, you cannot prepare yourself for anything like that in the world. It's a completely different experience. Any competition, if you did a big competition here or around the world, you know, kind of national competition, the FISM is just completely different. And you can't really describe it until you do it, because you come on cold. I don't know if you've ever been to a competition at FISM, but they don't introduce the acts. So you just have your name on the screen. And when the act's ready, they open the curtains and off you go. There's no warm up. There's nothing like that. And FISM watches can be very, what's the word? I'm trying to think nicely. They can be very harsh. So if they don't like you, they'll let you know. There used to be a thing called the FISM bird, which was the whistle. So if the act doesn't like you, you'll get booed off stage. You know, I've seen acts with curtains that come on. You know, they used to be very, very harsh. The reason being is because it's a collection of all the magic societies around the world. And if they think someone's at a good level, say from another country, that they don't know necessarily the level of other countries, then they'll put them through. So you used to get quite a majority of bad acts there. And they should have known better not to be going to that. So that's why they created these regional championships, the European Championships, the Asian Championships. So that's why they do it, to kind of filter out that, to make the competition as good as possible. So So even though I didn't get placed at the European Championships in 2011, I think I'd kind of, well, because it was England as well, and I think it's a British act, they kind of let me go and do that one as well, the World Championships. But it was good. It was probably the worst time I've ever had on stage, but it really kind of gave me a real kind of a grounding, and it kind of made me a lot stronger for future competitions. So after that, I then did the 2014 IBM, which is one we competed in.
Yep.
And Brian Miller was the organizer, and he booked me for a lecture. And he's like, "Look, you should have the competitions." And I'm like, "No, I'm done. You know, I'm fine. I'm done. I'm all right." And he's like, "No, I think you should. I think it'd be good for you." And I was like, "Okay, all right." So he said, "Well, I'll book you for a lecture anyway." So I went on and did the competition, and it was a great day. It was really good because I won it. And it was the day after, I think it was the award ceremony, and I went there. I never go there with the intention of thinking I'm going to win. So I think I did my lecture that morning, and I was going to go to the theatre in the evening. So I got a taxi there, thought I can have a couple of drinks after, no matter what happens. And then I was given I think originally was the Originality Award, was the first award I was given that. And then I got the DJ Shield for manipulation. And then I got the first prize. And then I was awarded the British Ring Shield as well.
Yeah.
More than one hit. And that was amazing. It was a great, great day, really fantastic. And great to be there in front of all these people that I know as well as part of the IBM. Mm. But the problem was I came by taxi, so I couldn't actually get these home back to my B&B. So I had to leave them there until the next day.
That's funny.
Yeah, I didn't think about that. But no, it was great. That was kind of, so I guess, all those years of, you know, that persistence of knowing I'm trying to get there. So I was kind of, over the years of the magic competition, I came nowhere, then I came third and I came second, and it just kind of crept up. And then I kind of got all these in one go, and it was amazing. It was kind of like all those years of thinking when I was 18, you know, winning these awards. And then in 2017, European Championships came back to Blackpool. And Danny Hunt was one of the judges, and he's like, "I think you should enter." I was like, "No, I'm done. Really, I got IBM trophy. It was great. It was nice and big and full." He's like, "Oh, I think you should. Why not? You've got nothing to lose." I was like, "Okay, why not?" So I entered it, and I'd also done the gala show at Blackpool that time. So I've done my act on that stage quite a few times now. So I was quite experienced with it. So I just went on, just kind of actually probably the best attitude of just like, "I'm just going to have fun. I'm just going to enjoy it." And I did, and went down really well, and I got awarded third place. I was going to get second actually, but I was 1 point away from second, but they didn't allow it, so I came third. But again, I wasn't expecting it. They didn't actually let me know that I'd been awarded it. So I, at the Blackpool, the gala show, I was up in the circle. I was actually up in the dress circle, the one above it. So when I announced my name, I had to run down from literally the top of the theatre all the way down to the stage. Now by that time, also you may have been announced, so your adrenaline's pumping anyway. And then I was scooting down all the stairs, down the back of the stairs, down onto the stage. By the time I got out there, I couldn't actually physically hold my trophy because I was like, the adrenaline was like this. So getting up on stage and getting that award and being with all these people, that was achieved, that was done. You know, from when I was 18, looking at kind of FISM in Dresden, I wanted to be up those people. And I had like Matt Wright, who was up there, and all these amazing people, these award winners. And it was possibly one of the best days of my life because not only had I won a FISM award, I don't care if I came third, got the FISM award. I was doing it on home turf, you know, and had all these people, my friends were in the audience and saw it, and it was fantastic. Yeah.
And it comes full circle because obviously you're at FISM. The thing that made you want to join FISM, once went to FISM, was many, many years before seeing Roy Davenport get third at FISM. And then, yeah, that's great. That's fantastic. Yeah. Did you retire from competitions at that point? Did you kind of think, you know what? Pinnacle, reach, done.
Do you know what? Yeah, I kind of lost my motivation after that. I'm like, well, this is it. What do I do now? You know, it's kind of that was it. I don't know what else to do. So I don't know. I still like to. It'd be nice to. I've come second and third in the Stage Magician of the Year, Magic Circle. So I'd like to maybe give that another go at some point. But if it doesn't mean that I'm quite happy with what I have, I've got a FISM trophy. I'm happy with it.
Do you think that these competitions that you won and the notoriety that you received from winning these competitions, do you reckon that helped your career as a performer away from magic? Or do you think it was kind of its own set? Because some people say to me, I enter competitions because I want to further my career and get social proof. While other people say to me, I don't. And I don't think that's going to help my career because my potential booker that's booking me for this event doesn't care if I won this magic competition. That's not on there.
Yeah, that is very true. I think you can just put award-winning magician and then that's enough, I think, for outside gigs, for the corporate sector or for anything like that. That's fine. I think these only kind of really count within the magic community. So from coming third in FISM, I got quite a few bookings for conventions. I went to Beijing, for example, did a lecture and things out there. And I think that's when it really kind of really counts in that world.
And you continue to do a lot of lectures, don't you? Like, which is, you're one of the only lecturers I know, or there's very few, that focus on a lecture specifically on stage magic. And when you get booked to do a convention, you're kind of the perfect person to book, because you don't just do a lecture, but you can also perform on the gala show as well, which a lot of acts can't do. You know, you book somebody to just be a lecturer and then they have to book a gala act, whilst you can do both, which is great.
Yeah, it's very, very handy for bookers. Yeah, absolutely. No, yeah, my lecture is, I specifically wanted to put it together because there wasn't many lectures out there on specifically stage magic. There's also a lot of cards and mentorism out there. So I wanted to put something out there, which people might not necessarily do, but just kind of give them an insight. I remember seeing people like Jeffrey Buckingham, who won FISM. He's the only kind of British guy that's won a FISM, and he did a lecture at Davenport's, and he basically kind of took his act, did it, and then just showed everything a part of it, like his loads, everything inside his coat. And I kind of remember seeing that and thinking that's what I'd like to do. So I took one of my routines, I do a bubble act in the routine, and put it together with these rules I was talking about for the Levant's rules, and kind of explaining how the rules kind of, you know, would equate to what I'm doing on my act. So it's basically kind of like it's the basics of kind of manipulation, but also a lot about stagecraft, positioning yourself, psychology behind steals, loading one hand to the other, that sort of thing. But also how you can adapt those rules and apply it to other genres of magic, from close up to stand up. Even kids magic will do something there as well. So it's kind of showing that all these kind of basic rules can apply to all types of magic. So yeah, it's something different. I was wanting to put something different out there too. Not necessarily, not everyone might not do it or get something from it, but it's kind of what I love and my interpretation of what I see of magic as.
Amazing. And very quickly, let me just ask you this now. If people wanted to book you for a lecture, you are available, they can reach. What's the best way? Because I'd highly recommend your lecture. I think it's brilliant. What's the best way for people that are around the world that want to book a really, I'm telling anyone who books lectures right now, this is an amazing lecture and Ola is a fantastic act. Where would they go and reach out to you to book you? Is it through your website or social media or?
Yeah, social media is probably the best thing. My website's having a bit of an overhaul at the minute, but social media, or also I've got a website called West End Magic, which is for a show I do in London, so you can go through there for emails. But yeah, social media is probably the best at the minute.
And people can reach out to you. Is it Oliver Tabor on Facebook? Are you on Instagram? Where?
Yeah, Facebook and Instagram. I think it's Oliver Tabor on the Facebook, and Otaber Magic on Instagram. Oh, sorry, yeah, on Instagram, yeah. Yeah. Okay. So I just want to add one thing, actually, because I'm doing competitions. I don't do them anymore, but I'm trying to encourage the next generation of competitors. Because mm-hmm. when I was younger, I had the bug for competing. So the IBM got in touch with me, the IBM British Ring, about kind of coming part of their convention, because their competition hadn't run for like 2 or 3 years after that. I think Edward Hilson won the year after me, and then they couldn't get enough people. So they asked if I wouldn't mind starting organising the competition. So for the last 4 or 5 years, I organised the stage competition for the IBM, just to kind of get people out there, if people are interested in doing stage magic. And that's one thing I think from winning competitions, that's one thing I wanted to do, was to help people and encourage people to get into this type of magic. You know, the kind of silent magic, we're just getting on stage and doing that kind of stuff, because there's not many people that do it over here these days. There's a few people, but in America or Europe, there's loads of these stage acts. And there are places to work in these days. You say there's a lot of places to work with them. So I'm trying to help people and encourage, especially the next generation. I work with people like Dean Levy, for example, the one, the Magician of the Year, and trying to help as many people as possible. So it just to kind of get that interest in there, because it's such a fantastic point of magic. And the great thing about kind of magic done to music, it kind of, you do it around the whole world. You know, there's a massive market out there. It's there's no language barrier.
Well, the nice thing about a stage competition, unlike a close-up, with a close-up competition, you're quite limited, because in terms of the environment you're in, it has to be, although having said that, I competed at Blackpool once in a close-up competition, and I got beaten by Jean Vanderput, who made a dog appear. So maybe I'm wrong, but generally, I'm not bitter. Generally, as a rule, in a close-up environment, you're kind of a little bit more limited. But in stage, you've got comedy, you've got physical comedy, you've got manipulation, you've got all the different types of manipulation, you've got illusions, there's mentalism, there's so many different ways and so many totally different acts that you can actually go and enter a stage competition with.
There is, absolutely, absolutely. And I think some people are put off by competitions, especially the big ones like the IBM, because it's very prestigious. It's been going for since 1938. You know, it's the oldest stage competition over here, and also the Magic Circle. But I just want to try and encourage people just to come out there and do it. As I said, everyone, just go out there and do it. If you win your local stage competition, then maybe think about coming to do another one. Come do the big one.
So how can people get advice if they reach out to you on social media? Can they get advice and say, look, this is my act. Do you think it's good enough to be, you know, with them?
Yeah, of course. Absolutely. I'd be more than happy to. Yeah, that's it. Definitely. There's a guy called Fraser Stokes who does an act called Hamish. And if you've not seen him, he's awesome. And I really think he could go on and do stuff at FISM if he wants to. He does a manipulation act dressed as a clown. It's very kind of atmospheric. But his manipulations are just unbelievable, like really shit hot. So he came third in the first IBM competition organised. He came third. Next year he came second. And the following year he came first. But he did a different act for each one. Like he was changing. He was got to come up with different things every time. Yeah. And he had that bug, that kind of like wants to do well. And I think it's on Facebook, his Hamish act, but it's just awesome. It's just his manips, his ball manips and his card manips are just, they're up there with the FISM lot.
Wow. He's
really, really cool. And also Taylor Morgan entered FISM this year with his balloon act. But again, he's the only Brit that entered. The only British guy. There's no one in close up. It's just a real shame. I mean, when we had the European Championships in 2017, there was a few people like Matt Wright entered and a couple of others, but we don't seem to have that need to enter these FISM competitions and put a stamp up there as, like, you know, British magicians.
I think one of the reasons for that is that, or maybe I'm wrong, but having spoken to a lot of people on this channel, you know, a lot of people that are getting into magic, that are passionate about magic, they kind of aren't performing in a stage environment as much as they did back in my day, in your day. A lot of it's done on social media. Like I meet so many magicians that 99% of their performances are on social media.
Right.
Take that and try and put it on a stage. It's a very difficult thing to do because.
Yeah, no, it's a fair point. And also, a few years ago, I did some workshops, children's workshops at Davenport's, and all the kids back there were just doing card stuff. We're trying to introduce them to other things, other props, but it's still about the cards because of from Dynamo's influence.
Yeah,
all the magicians today have all kind of influenced the next generation. It's all come from the cards, the cardistry, and all that sort of thing. That's what I want to do, which actually isn't that far away from manipulation, I have to say, cardistry. You know, I reckon if you give someone a deck of cards and give them a week and teach them how to do back palms, they could probably do it within the week, I'd say, those guys.
But they're so talented.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, you're right, especially with the social media thing as well. I just, it's not really a call for it. It's people aren't kind of really interested in doing so much on stage. But it's a shame. I think everything comes around full circle, like everything does. So I think it will come around back eventually. I just don't think it's. I think also it's. I mean, there is to put the stage act together. It does take a lot of work in some ways. You got to think about all different elements of the music and the staging and all that, and also putting the work into the practice as well. But it's. I don't know. I find it the most rewarding. And as you say, I think a stage act like that is kind of what you imagine real magic to be.
Yeah. When I first got into magic, it was what I wanted to do, nothing else. I remember saving up all of my money to buy a chair suspension. I had no idea what I was going to do with it. I just desperately wanted this chair suspension. That's what I wanted. And I got it and it stayed in my bedroom for a long time. And it didn't get used for a long time, but I just wanted, I had, my room was just full of weird and wonderful stage props because I used to just stand there and imagine myself being a stage magician. So, yeah, I totally get where you're coming from. When is the next IBM? So what's the time frame we have on this?
So next IBM convention is going to be in Eastbourne next year.
Okay.
First weekend.
Around September, October, isn't it?
Sort September. Of yeah, first week of September. It is the 2nd to the 5th, I think, or something like that off the top of my head. But it's going to be a good one. I'm not to say it's because I'm obviously part of the council, but because we haven't actually had a convention for 2 years, we've done a lot of online conventions, virtual conventions and a couple of other online events, but because we haven't had a convention for 2 or 3 years, you know, we have a lot of plans in place to make it the best convention we can try and do. And
IBM was my favourite convention for years, and the last few years it's died off a little bit. I'd love to see it make a comeback. I really would, because it was so friendly. And
yeah, that's it. I mean, that's, everyone says that when I go to the IBM convention, and we kind of call it the friendly convention because it really is. We had an event at the weekend in Hinckley. It was organised by Richard Cadell just to get people to get together again. And it's always got that lovely, friendly, nice atmosphere, really kind of relaxed. And it always isn't the same convention. But the IBM has kind of suffered over the last few years. But there's been a new council coming on, and we've got different ideas. And so next year, we're planning to go back to how we were. So we're going to get some Physimax. I think we've got some Physimax booked already, and get some real big people back in and get to do like a whole, you know, a great kind of 4 or 5 days of events. So it'd be great. And it'd be really fun. And also next year I become the president of the IBM. So it's my my convention next year. So I have to say this, don't I, really? I have to say that it's going to be a great convention. So it's going to be great. It really is. And I can't wait. I was supposed to be president a couple of years ago, but also because of the pandemic, Alan Maskell's, accepted for 2 years and has done a great job. We've been doing like a social meetups on Zoom every month and keeping in touch with our members and doing different events and having lectures. So he's done, a much better job than I could have done online. He's done amazingly well. But I can't wait to kind of take over and do what I can to encourage kind of like that, get everyone back again, you know, get the younger members, get them interested. That's kind of what we're aiming to do. And also still run the competition and see if anyone would like to enter the competition and get that back up and going and everyone interested.
When you've got the lineup sorted, perhaps you can come back on Magic TV and we can promote the convention and talk about the different acts that you've got going on and the competitions, and we can talk about and hopefully get a few more, you know, people going back to, because I'd definitely go, I'd take Ryland. I'd 100%, because it's such a great convention.
Mate, absolutely, very welcome. Yeah, I'd love that. I'd love to come back on and talk about that. That'd be awesome.
That would be great.
Yeah.
I just want to go back onto one thing that we were talking about earlier on, very quickly. You were talking about, obviously, your career and, you know, it was getting higher and higher and higher. And then you were doing conventions at the same time. Obviously, you got to a very, very, very high level. And then obviously COVID hit and it affected all of us. But you've been a huge inspiration since COVID because you've bounced back really well. You're now part of, is it Illusions Impossible?
That's right, Illusion Impossible, yeah.
Which is, I haven't seen it, I'd love to see it. I believe James and Dylan Piper are involved in it as well, aren't they?
That's right.
Yeah.
So it's James and Dylan Piper, Jamie Raven, myself and my partner, because we do Illusion Act, and Caden Black, who's like the main illusionist in the show.
Wow, what a great lineup.
Yeah, no, it's an amazing show. It's a cracking show. We just want to get on with things, just get on, you know. It's just frustrating. So it actually came out of the pandemic, this. It's one of the best things to come out of it. The nice positive spin on what happened in the last 15 months is kind of Caden phoned me up and said, look, we've kind of put this show together. So a few theatres on the circuit have asked for a magic show again. Would you be interested? And I was like, yeah, great. And he said, you know, could you do your dove act and do you want to do something else? And at the time, I'm performing as part of the double act called The Glamorists, which is basically kind of like an illusion act. So we're kind of doing, so we've got, so we're doing a second spot tour, second half in the show with that as well. So then all these dates started coming in, even before they made a trailer. You know, these theatres were kind of desperate for just amazing help. Even before we went down to Portsmouth, down to the King's Theatre to do a trailer, and there was already about 10 or 15 dates in already, even before we made the trailer for the show. There was such a demand out there.
That's crazy.
So we were supposed to start in March this year. Then it was pushed back to April and May. Then we had one show in July. So we only had one show so far. And all the other shows were supposed to have another 28 dates, I think it was, this year, are just being pushed back just for a number of reasons, mainly, I think, because people are apprehensive to get back into theatre just yet. So some shows are selling well, some weren't, but I think it was just from the company's decision, it's just the best thing just to kind of postpone to next year. So we did one show in Tunbridge Wells in July, which was good. Obviously, there's a few kind of teething problems you get in the first show, but we got a great reaction. It was really good. And it's a big show. I mean, it's a really big show. Caden's stuff is massive. He's got things like double levitation, and well, he's got, I think it's about 15 illusions in it originally. It's just jam packed full of illusions of everything. And then Caden, Caden does two spots. Jamie's kind of like the host, Jamie Raven, who's also fantastic. And then James Dillon did a couple of spots as well. And then there's my dub act in the first half. And then we've got the glamorous spot in the second half with a big Fabergé egg. I don't know if anyone's seen it. So we've got this big, massive Fabergé egg made where my partner Vicky gets inside it and vanishes and reappears at the end as a butterfly. So it's quite, I mean, that's quite big in itself, a quick illusion to transport around. So so it's going to be great. It's going to be a really, really good show. So we're going to start in January next year. and it's going to run away through to, I think it's November. So we've still got dates coming in. Wow. So if anyone's interested, it's just going to illusionimpossible.co.uk or .com. And it's got all the tour dates on there, all the links to the tickets.
Amazing.
So check it out. Are
you hoping to go down the same route as the Illusionists and the Champions of Magic and take that abroad?
I think so. Yeah, there are plans. I think the producers are speaking with some theatres abroad already. I think there's one in Singapore, possibly one in Dubai, and I think even America as well, if they will come out. So that's the idea. Yeah, so I think kind of tour it around England for a year and then see where else we can take it.
That's great. That's fantastic. And you mentioned earlier on you're also doing West End Magic. What's
West End Magic? Yeah, so that's a show which has been on for about 8 years now. It's again, that was just what I think I wanted to do. So from the Dema Club days, we used to put on the show to the public and always wanted to come on. We used to come encouraged to put on a different act every time for Ferguson. Ferguson gave us great feedback. And the club disbanded in 97. 10 years later, a few of us members got together and was like, should we put a show on again? It's been 10 years. So we hired out the Albany Theatre in Deptford and put on kind of like the Dema Club Presents. And it's basically everyone now, 10 years later, and we kind of did a show and put it all back together. It was great, really good show. And then we did it a couple of years later at the Players Theatre in London. We did it for 2 years running, and we kind of did as much as we could. I think it kind of ran its path. And I always wanted to kind of carry on, but I knew how to try and do a different rebranding of it. So I was looking for theatres to try and find and put this the show on. And I kind of given up. I went to kind of like RADA and trying to hire out their theatre at different theatre schools. And then I suddenly came across Leicester Square Theatre, which is right in the heart of Leicester Square. It's like an underground theatre. It's mainly a comedy theatre. So I had a meeting with them and said, look, I'll do a kind of a family kind of magic show. It's not for kids, but it's basically anyone can come watch it. And I was like, okay, try it out. So it's very self-indulgent. So I basically put on a show that I wanted to perform with. So the first show was in 2013, and we had Michael Jordan, Hijinks.
He's amazing.
He's awesome. He's really good. So he came into The Illusions. We had Christian Lee, who was the compere.
Very funny guy.
Yeah, it's great. We had Steve Hewlett.
Oh, yeah. Brilliant.
And Richard Griffin.
What a lineup.
Yeah, it's an amazing lineup. So I've always wanted to perform with Richard because he's always been the guy that inspired me to do the magic one. I've always wanted to get on the show with him. So I'll put that on, just purely self-indulgent, printed programs, that sort of thing. I did two or three spots myself, and we had about 200 people, I think, turn up. Didn't make any money, but it's just purely just for the fun of it. And the theatre approached me. It's like, look, do you want to carry this on? We think it's got legs. So it was an evening show. And he said, if you put it in the afternoon, we'll lower the fee, the high fee. So we booked in, I think, three shows for the following year. And again, it didn't make any money. And in the following year, we did it. We had a different lineup every time. So it wasn't the same lineup. It was me doing about four spots or so, just because it's cheaper. Doing more spots yourself than hiring other acts in. So different acts like, excuse me, like Matt Ricardo and the Card Ninja and people I worked with at Magic Night used to kind of get them on and do a rotation.
Brilliant.
So like any business, it takes 5 years to make money. So after putting these shows on, it started making a little bit of cash and started to build a reputation and build an audience. Yeah. And the Leicester Square Theatre has more become a comedy-based theatre. So they were trying to have family shows in there, have like Stick Men for Christmas, or Stick Man, sorry. And it was starting to build an audience. Plus, we were putting on magic workshops as well. We thought, if we put magic workshops on before, it would cross-market.
Mm, good idea.
Really helps doing that. And then they opened up the Museum of Comedy, which is another sister venue of the company, which has like a little small 60-seat theatre. So we used to put workshops on there every month and then do an hour show after. And then also we could cross promote the Big Show as well.
Brilliant.
We did that for a few years. And it's just kind of grown and grown. And it's just kind of been a dream of mine to have a show in the West End. It's not a massive theatre. It's only a 400-seater. And it's like a kind of a cabaret. I mean, it has got a nice stage. So it's just, but I also, my actual, the reason I do this and is because I love putting on shows. I absolutely love it. The reason being, not for making any money necessarily, it does help you make a bit of money, but purely to show what great acts are out there. Yeah. I love seeing audiences have a good time. And there's nothing better for me than, I mean, I'm much better at promoting shows than myself. I find it very uncomfortable sometimes promoting myself, but if I put on a show and with a name on it, I can do that. That's fine. I can do that all day. So there's obviously the Britain's Got Talent does is a great avenue for people, but there's not obviously a great avenue for all the acts out there. And there's some fantastic acts on the circuit, from the cabaret circuit to the theatre circuit. There's some amazing people out there. So I love showing the public these acts. It's my way of showing them people what great acts are out there. Like I mentioned, like Matt Ricardo, the Card Ninja. There's a guy called Wes Zahurik, who is a great comedy performer. There's Florian Brooks, who does the juggling. Awesome performer. And all these people, and just there's amazing guys who work in the cabaret world who are just brilliant. And also have hired different magicians, usually get different headliners. So we've had like Jamie Raven, Richard Jones, had Romany, Faye Presto, Mandy Muden. And we had just recently had a show. So we've been closed for about 18 months. So the last show we had, which was in October, we had Max Fulham, the ventriloquist, and Matt Daniel Baker. And it was a really good show. It was really nice. That's actually the first show I had back. Was October, so basically it was we had the audiences that have kind of been run over from the other shows that have been cancelled, so they came to this one, and we had about 150 people, but it was a great audience. The last show I did was West End Magic, which was back in March 2020, and it was a week before the first lockdown came in.
Wow.
It was the last show I did, and at the time I was performing at the Hippodrome. I had a residency at the Hippodrome in the Hippodrome Casino in Leicester Square, so I was doing that every Friday night. And as those weeks went on, leading up to it, those audiences got smaller and smaller at the Hippodrome. And in the West End Magic, we had 300, we pretty much sold out, but we had 200 people turn up. But they social distanced themselves, even before social distance existed, because they heard about this COVID, that something was happening, wasn't good. So people were kind of very wary about sitting next to each other. So there was pockets of people in the audience. And it was a really strange show. It's had a really odd feel. So we had Danny Buckley was the compere. We had Faye Presto. We had Megan Swan, who's now the president. So it was a cracking show, really good. But the audience were just tense. You know, they could feel something was coming. And then come around to October, which is our next show after the pandemic. And what a difference, man. We had 150, 200 people in, and it could have been 1,000 people, the noise they made. It was just love, and they couldn't wait to be out and show their appreciation. And it was a really good show. It was a great show we had. We had Daddy Lee Grew on it as well, and a guy called Wayne Trice, who's always my compere now as well for the shows. But, man, what an atmosphere. What a difference.
Wayne's a really great guy. Wayne Trice is really good guy. Really good guy.
Yeah, he's actually...
A lot of people don't know who he is, but he's really... he's got chops.
He certainly has. Yeah, he has. He has. And actually, he was from the Demon Club. That's where I know him from.
Oh, wow. Cool.
He's an old member of the Demon Club. He always used to help out backstage. He was the backstage manager. He was never, ever a performer. He was never comfortable being on stage doing those shows. So through the years, he did amateur dramatics. He used to work for Barclays, I think. And then he gave up that job and always wanted to do magic. So about 6-7 years ago, he started taking up professionally. And Wayne's a really good guy to have around. He's a really nice guy. He's great backstage, really chirpy, and he's great on stage as well. Mm. You know, he's a perfect compare because he can kind of relate to so many different people. So now he's kind of the compare that I have for the shows. And you say, he's just great. He's a great, really great guy. He's kind of like my kind of partner in those sort of shows because he kind of runs these. So, for example, we're taking West End Magic up to Edinburgh next year because I've always wanted to do it. So we're going to do an hour show. So it's going to be me and Wayne in a guest act every show. But he's just, he's a really good person to have there as part of your team.
That's awesome. So I've got two more questions to ask you before we wrap this up. The first question is, you've talked about how you enjoy entering competitions and it's something that it has driven you and you've put yourself in very stressful situations over the year, including Fissom. My question is, would you ever consider going on Britain's Got Talent? You mentioned it a couple of times. Obviously, you work with Jamie Raven and, you know, on the touring show, and James Dylan Piper, and you've mentioned Richard as well. You know, there's a lot of people that are doing really well. You would do really well as well. And magic has become more accepted now. You look at, you know, the show, and, you know, I think the last final, there were half the acts were magicians. Is that something that you'd consider as well, or is it something that you kind of think, nah, it's not for me?
I don't know. I've always kind of played around with it, but I'm not entirely sure. I did actually get phoned up by the producers of Britain's Got Talent the year after that Darcy Oak entered. And he said, look, we had a Dove act on here last year. Why don't you enter this year? And I was like, I don't really think I'm really suitable. Darcy Oak's this kind of core, wears a leather jacket, is like, you know, a bit more kind of hip. And I was like, we had a Dove act on last year. I don't really think that's going to work somehow. I don't know. I don't know if... maybe it would. My type of magic, they don't really seem to go for that sort of thing, really. The same on Penn and Teller Flawless. So there is better these days, like Leah Kyle, the quick change act. She was on Flawless, and she was like a silent act, and she works. But you don't get that many silent acts on Flawless. There's a few, but not that many. And that type of magic is not really on Britain's Got Talent as much, really. It's, you need to have that kind of emotional hook. Jones and Dylan Piper, for example, were perfect with the father and son thing, or you need to have like an emotional backstory. I don't know. It would be nice to do that, but I don't think my type of magic necessarily works that well. It would work that well. I think you need to have more of a story, more of a patter act, I think, these days. More of an emotional engagement, I think, than just walking on stage and doing visual magic.
Yeah.
I might be wrong. Maybe things might change. You know, magic did obviously change on Britain's Got Talent, and they start to like magicians, but I don't think... There's not been many acts on there that have done that well, apart from Darcy Oak, of course. I don't know. I want to rule it out. Maybe one day.
Maybe one day. Watch this space. Okay. And I suppose the final question is, what's next? I mean, is there anything left on your magical bucket list that you haven't actually achieved? Because you've done so much. I mean, you know, you said at the beginning you wanted to compete at FISM. You have. You've won an award at FISM. You've won numerous awards. You've literally lectured and performed at magic conventions all over the world. You set up your own West End show. You're now in a touring show that could potentially go worldwide. You've performed on stage. Very few people perform just exclusively on stage. Most of your stuff comes from stage. You do illusions, you do close, manipulation. I mean, most magicians would only dream of having the career that you've had. And you know, I know you're very humble, but it's true. If you break down everything that you've done and everything that you've achieved, you just take one of those aspects and say to a magician, would you be happy if you did your whole career and you got to perform, you know, run your own West End show and West End. All of these things. So you've done so much. But I know you're also very driven and ambitious. Is there anything left that you want to do? Is there anything left on your magical bucket list? What plans have you got moving forward?
God, that's a really good question. One thing I'd actually really like to do is the Magic Castle. That's a big tick on my bucket list. I've got a whiteboard at home with all the things I want to achieve. One was Edifism, all that sort of thing. And the Magic Castle's been on there for quite a few years. And I was almost there at one point. But the problem is I'm an act who's has to come from UK. I'm an act that's got to travel, and with doves as well. So it's not an easy act to travel with. I mean, you can borrow someone else's doves, which I have done in the past. So it's not impossible. But yeah, Magic Castle, I'd love to do a week at the Magic Castle. That's always the thing I think it would be a great honour to do. And it's great to be part of. So that's, yeah. I think that, I mean, the touring show is always, again, that's the one thing I've always wanted to do. And being part of it, I'm so excited to be part of a touring show. You know, again, that's everyone's kind of dream to do. And that's kind of like, if that happens, if the touring show happens, and then that's it, I'll probably be quite happy. I don't think there's much more I can do. There probably is other people, but I think I'm quite content with what I've done so far. So if someone says you've got to give up magic tomorrow, or you've got to do something else, or something comes up, I think I'll be okay. But then the touring show might lead to other things as well, and say go around the world. And so I don't know. Yeah, Magic Castle would be great. Magic Castle would be really cool. I think it'd be a nice big tick on my list.
Well, you know what? I mean, people in America watch this. If you're watching this and you have something to do with the Magic Castle, book this man, without a shadow of a doubt. Because you could go over there and do a mini lecture tour as well while you're over. You could kill two birds with one stone.
Yeah, very true.
Say to a dove manipulator, really, kill two birds with one stone. But you could thinking about it. But you could go over there and you could be, you know, you could be doing some lectures over there. You could work the Magic Castle. I think that anybody's watching this. I know Pop Hayden watches this. He was on the channel a couple of weeks ago. I know he's at the Magic Castle all the time. Pop, if you're watching this, get your people to contact Oliver because he would be amazing. That's all I'm going to say about that. But whatever you end up doing, I know that you're going to be super successful because you are an incredible performer. And you know what I love about you, Oliver? You care about magic. You love magic. You care about magic. You also care about the future of magic. And you're one of these people who likes to give back and really build people up and not push them down. And there's not many people like that. So, you know.
Do you know, that is really important, really, really important. I'd like to, you've got to kind of encourage people because, as I say, it doesn't happen much out there. There's also a lot of things on social media and groups, and there's some things are good, some things aren't. But I think there's nothing wrong being nice and helping people. You know, it's if everyone was a bit more like that, I think everyone would be doing a lot more things they wanted to do. So, for example, like when I was growing up, and it's about giving something back. I got so much help when I was younger, and even from my dub act, you know, everyone gave me ideas. Bobby Bernard, for example, the great Bobby Bernard, gave me the idea of taking the music sheet and shaking the notes out and showing it empty. That's not my idea. That's Bobby's idea, you know, which is now a main staple of my act.
Yeah.
Other people gave me bits and pieces of information. The act that you see today is, I don't know, 30-40% me and 60% everyone else, you know, from feedback I got from people and from help and from advice and all that. So, everyone gave me so much, and Brian Miller, I need to mention Brian Miller because he was a massive influence and big help on me, who sadly passed away about a month ago. But he booked me for the IBM. You know, he was a great friend and he used to come to all my shows and support me. And he booked me for the IBM and knew I'd had a chance of winning. And from that, went on to better things. You know, he's a great support. So Brian Miller was a big dub act in his day in the 70s and was a big support of a lot of people. So there's all these people that really funny, really helped. And we say, you know, we stand on the shoulders of giants, and it's so true because we're just people, we're nothing without them. And I had so many help over time. So I just want to give something back to people and see other people do just as well or feel better.
That's fantastic. And they couldn't have picked a better person to be president of the IBM. If anybody's going to take that convention to the next level, I really think it's you. And if people haven't seen your act, they need to go out their way to do so. I know you're appearing at lots of conventions and you're appearing at lots of gala shows and things like that. If you see Oliver on the bill, go and see him. I mean, we've glossed over your music act. We mentioned it at the beginning and we mentioned very briefly about the sign turning into magic. I have to tell you, that's one of my favorite moments. I miss it every single time. It's just like, I look away and I'm like, I must have seen your act about four times, and every time I think, right, I'm gonna catch it now, and I always miss it, and I'm like, son of a bitch, it's just so good, it's so good, it really is. It's cool, it's such a great act, and I'm sure you will continue to have the success that you deserve, Oliver.
Thank you, Craig. Thanks very much.
No problem, guys. I'm going to ask you to leave a comment down below because I'm sure Oliver will see them. Connect with him on Facebook and Instagram. And please, if you're thinking about entering a competition, speak to Oliver and speak to him about the IBM, because I think that, you know, I think that that would be a really good thing for people to do. And make sure you can go and watch him perform. And you can check out West End Magic. I'm going to put links down in the description for West End Magic and everything else that you're doing. And if people want to book a lecture, I'm going to put details down there. So there's going to be lots of links. You can follow those. But one more time, Oliver, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, mate. Thanks so much. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
No problem. Guys, I'll see you again tomorrow with another video. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Talk Magic Podcast.
Magic, magic.
Be sure to like and subscribe to the Magic TV YouTube channel.
Magic TV.
Which includes 14 unique videos every week. Whatever type of magic you're interested in, we've got you covered. Just search YouTube for Craig Petty's Magic TV, or click on the link in the description from this podcast below. Be sure to join us next Friday at 5 p.m. right here for another Talk Magic Podcast.